From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the ska revival. Ska is the Jamaican music that precedes reggae. The Skatalites, the band that originated the sound in the 50s, is now leading the revival. We'll meet the band's trumpeter, Nathan Breedlove. Also, now that our summer vacations are over, and so is the Labor Day weekend, we're back to the grind, racing against the clock. We'll talk with Dr. Stefan Reckstoffen, author of Time Shifting, about how to change our relationship to time. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of duets and arias, featuring a couple who got married last spring between performances at the Met. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Congressional reaction to today's U.S. missile strikes on Iraq has been positive, but world reaction has been mixed. President Clinton spoke to the nation from the Oval Office today, saying the missile attacks were triggered by Saddam Hussein's actions. Iraqi troops are still in northern Iraq after assaulting an Iraqi town of Kurdish residents over the weekend. President Clinton says the U.S. missile action was necessary.
We must make it clear that reckless acts have consequences, or those acts will increase. We must reduce Iraq's ability to strike out at its neighbors, and we must increase America's ability to contain Iraq over the long run.
The president also expanded the no-fly zone in southern Iraq to prevent military flights from Baghdad's suburbs south to the Iraqi border with Kuwait. Saddam Hussein says he won't recognize the no-fly zones anymore. He has ordered his troops to act against any foreign planes in Iraqi airspace. American officials have briefed Israeli officials on the cruise missile attack on southern Iraq. Israeli analysts say they do not believe the conflict will spread. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
American ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, today met Israel's foreign minister, David Levy, to brief him on the American attack. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesman issued a calming statement saying there's no cause for alarm and the public can continue with normal life. During the Gulf War 5 years ago, Iraq fired 39 Scud missiles at Israel. Iraq also has chemical weapons, although did not use them against Israel. All Israelis have gas masks distributed before the Gulf War and later replaced with newer models. Israeli officials say there's no reason at this time for people to prepare to use the gas masks. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, France, a U.S. ally, reacted coolly to the missile strike in Iraq. David Culhane reports from Paris.
France withheld its support for the attack and made clear its reservations in a carefully worded statement. In essence, the foreign ministry said that France had been informed in advance and that the French government is concerned about the evolution of the situation in Iraq. Western diplomats reading between the lines say the real message from France, and indeed from other allies behind the scenes, is let's make this as short and sharply defined as possible and then step back. French diplomats did send a message to Iraq urging the withdrawal of its forces from the northern territories and stressing that dialogue is the only real solution to the problems in the area. France has said for some time that Iraq's sovereignty should be respected within its own territory. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 18.5 points at 5,597. Trading's light. The Nasdaq Composite Index has fallen about 6 points to 1135. This is NPR. Residents of the Bahamas and parts of Florida are preparing for Hurricane Fran. Forecasters say it's about 395 miles east of Nassau and moving north-northeast. Top winds are measured at 85 miles per hour, and Fran is expected to gain strength. The storm could reach U.S. shores this week, and Florida residents are being warned to get ready now because, as it stands, the storm should pass east of Cape Canaveral by tomorrow morning. Fran could be near Georgia or South Carolina by Friday morning, but the path of the storm is nowhere near certain. Dr. Jack Kevorkian attended the death last night of a 73-year-old Tennessee man. From member station WDET in Detroit, Lori Pyunk reports.
Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, says the body of Jack Leatherman of Knoxville, Tennessee, was taken to a hospital in Oakland County about 8 o'clock last night. Figer told the Oakland Press that Leatherman had been in contact with Kevorkian since he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in May. Figer says the death happened in Michigan, but would not be more specific. A hospital spokeswoman says Kevorkian handed the emergency room physician a 3x5 card that gave the man's name, age, residence, and name of his son. Leatherman is the 39th death Kevorkian has acknowledged attending since 1990. He was present at 5 deaths last month. For National Public Radio, this is Lori Pionk in Detroit.
Convicted Whitewater figure Susan McDougal says she is tempted to cooperate with prosecutors. McDougal gave an interview to ABC's Primetime Live show, and parts of the interview were reported today in the Washington Post. McDougal says Whitewater prosecutors are doing all they can to get her to implicate President and Mrs. Clinton, but she says she doesn't have any such information. McDougal and her ex-husband James owned the savings and loan at the center of the Whitewater affair. Susan will begin her prison sentence later this month. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before there was reggae, there was ska, a Jamaican music that fused jazz, pop, and rhythm and blues with an island beat. Now there's a ska revival, and at the forefront is the band that originated the music in the 1960s, the Skatalites. The Skatalites inspired the musical movement not only through their own records, but by playing behind such performers as Jimmy Cliff, Bob Marley, and Toots and the Maytals. Today the band includes several original members, saxophonist Tommy McCook and Roland Alfonso, drummer Lloyd Nibbs, and bassist Lloyd Brevet. The youngest member of the group is a trumpet player from Memphis, my guest Nathan Breedlove. Here's his composition, Ska Mania, from the latest Skatalites album, High Bop Ska. Nathan Breedlove, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, I thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
How did ska get its name?
There's stories about that. There was an early legendary figure that used to run around Jamaica, and he called everybody Skavuvi. Skavuvi, like sort of like Lionel Hampton calls everybody Gates. You know, it's like, I guess you can't remember the person's name. So this name, Skavuvi, was integral with the name ska, and the beat itself was called ska, because when you tried to explain it to a musician how you play the rhythm, it was explained ska 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 like that, and sort of like that some type of way. It's kind of hard to pinpoint the exact person who coined the phrase ska.
Now, the guy who owned the recording studio that the Skatalites started recording for, he also ran a sound system, which I guess was basically like being a disc jockey and going to different dance halls all around Jamaica.
Right.
The story I've heard is that he used to play American rhythm and blues and stuff.
Oh, yes, yes.
And then there was a period when he decided he wanted a more homegrown music, that it would be better and it would be more profitable. Do you know what happened there? Why wasn't the rhythm and blues working at the dances anymore? Why did he feel he needed to change?
Well, the way I hear it is that it wasn't a thought-out process like that. It was more that as the musicians tried to play the rhythm and blues, they came up with their own form and style of it, which was different. It was like the rhythm and blues, but it had that Jamaican sort of rhythmic spin on it, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So in that working together with the two styles of Jamaica's early Minto music and Calypso, along with the R&B, is where the ska came up. And Lloyd Nibb is largely responsible for that, the drummer, because he changed the beat around and came up with a unique beat that we know as ska music now.
Now, Lloyd Nibbs, who you just mentioned,
yes.
He's still with the band.
Yes, yes. The rhythm section is still intact, the bass and drummer.
So it must be pretty exciting to be playing with the people who actually invented the music.
Oh, yeah. It's really, you can't put it in words, because Lloyd Brevet, the bass player, is he goes back to the big band era. His father was a bass player in Jamaica, and he used to build basses. So it's to me, it's like the original jazz community, you know, with the larger-than-life individuals like Art Blakey and Dexter Gordon and all the eccentricities and, you know, just the personalities, larger than life. That's the way I describe it mostly.
Now, why don't we play two records back-to-back? Let's play the Scatolites' early recording of Man in the Street. I think this is probably their first recording of it.
Okay.
And compare that to a recent Scatolites recording of Man in the Street, one in which you're performing.
Okay.
And tell us what you think the difference is before we hear them both.
The current band is, we're heavily into the jazz spectrum. So now, even though it was earlier, prior, in the early days, it had a stronger Jamaican influence. And now it's the balance is tilted largely through Tommy McCook to the jazz side. So I would say we're a little jazzier. The tempos are a little faster because the kids, the energy level of our planet is a little, you know, higher. It spins a little faster or whatever. And so they want to hear the music played a little faster. So we have to adjust the tempo somewhat.
Okay, so this is the Scatolites from the mid-60s and the mid-90s. My guest is Nathan Breedlove, the trumpeter with the Scatolites. The song that we just heard, Man in the Street, was written by the Scatolites' first trombonist, Don Drummond. And his story actually ends pretty tragically in the 1960s. What happened?
Well, Don's life was a study in tragedy of the creative genius musician. There's different stories about what actually started his eccentricities, but he had mental problems, and the only solace that he could find was in his music. So what happened was the bass player, Lloyd Brevet, had some problems and couldn't play for a while. And so Don, I guess, didn't really care for the bass substitutes that they tried to use for this brief period of time. And so he stopped playing, and he had a tragic love affair with one of the most beautiful women in Jamaica. She was a model, and they were like one of Jamaica's leading couples. Her name was Marguerite. And so they sort of had this tragic love affair. And there's many stories about, you know, what ensued. But what happened was he didn't take his medicine, and he stabbed her to death. And then he ran out to the police station in his underwear, and they committed him, and he died in the asylum.
About 5 years after the murder?
Less than 5 years, yeah. He didn't live 5 years after that.
What impact did that have on the band?
Well, the band broke up in 65. Because the band, original band, was only together 13 months. Between 13 and 15 months.
It's such a short time for such an influential group.
Oh, I know. And the prolific amount of recordings that they turned out for that time. Because there's allegedly over 1,000 recordings with the Scatolites.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really phenomenal. That's a record a day. Two records a day. Yeah, but I can't say enough about Don Drummond and it's just his style, you know. Because when you think of trombone, you don't think of something that sounds really... I know the trombone players of the world are going to write mail, but you don't think of a real beautiful sound like a saxophone or something. But Don had the most warm sound that I've ever heard, really.
Actually, why don't I play another recording that'll show off his sound?
Okay.
And this is called Roll On, Sweet Don.
Okay.
And I think it's maybe also called Heaven and Hell.
Probably.
So this is featuring trombonist Don Drummond. Late trombonist Don Drummond, one of the original members of the Scatolites. And my guest is Nathan Breedlove, who is one of the newer members of the Scatolites. Now, the Scatolites stopped performing in the mid-60s after being together only 13 months.
In 65,
they broke up. Then they reunited in 1983. How did they end up coming back together again?
The story of the breakup is really interesting in itself, but the way they got together was a Sunsplash.
Well, let's go back to the story of the breakup. I want to skip that.
Well, there's many. If you talk to each of the original Scatolites, they each have a version of how the band, the story of the band's demise. And one story I hear is that they were playing a gig at a place called Beaumont, and the bass man, Lloyd Brevet, used to like to watch Bonanza every night. And so he wouldn't leave to do the gig until he had seen Bonanza. So one night he was late to the gig. Everyone was late. And so when they get to the club and start to play, the audience just looked at them, right? And then everybody just walked out of the place. There was silence. No one said a word. It was like Jamaica's way of, getting back or insulting the band. So everybody just left the place, and after that, the band just broke up. And then that's one story. And another story is that they had an outdoor concert, and just the personalities, the conflicts between Roland and Tommy and Johnny Dizzy Moore, and just the whole group, you know. It's very volatile and, you know, creative mixture. And so that's how they say the band broke up.
So the members of the band don't agree on the story of how they broke up?
No. They all blame each other, essentially.
Did they agree on the story of how the band got back together in 83?
Yes, for the Sunsplash of 83, I think it was. Herbie Miller, he's in the music business, and I think he used to manage Third World or something. He was responsible for bringing some of the musicians from Jamaica to the States and helping them with their papers and everything, and put the band together for the 83 Sunsplash.
And the Sunsplash is a big Jamaican music festival.
Yeah.
My guest is Nathan Breedlove, trumpeter with the Scatolites. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nathan Breedlove, trumpeter with the Scatolites, the band that created the ska sound in the 60s and is now at the forefront of the ska revival. Now, where do you enter the picture of the Skatalites?
I come in the picture in 1990. I was playing with Lionel Hampton's band, and a friend of mine, Joshua Roseman, told me about this band playing ska music. I had never heard of ska. Of course, I shouldn't say that, but I was interested and intrigued, so I went to the audition and Tommy McCook and I liked each other, and I was really pleased with the music because I was apprehensive at first because I thought it was going to be reggae, which to a jazz instrumentalist is like, it's not fun music to play for us, to say it honestly, you know. You're limited rhythmically and harmonically. We have 1,000 excuses. So I was pleased to see that it was very, very close to jazz. I call it Jamaican jazz to this day, you know, ska music.
Well, you know, I'm almost surprised that they hired you. You're not Jamaican. You didn't know ska. You didn't know all the tunes. You didn't know the history.
No. But it's jazz, like I said. And so I was with the band for 5 years until Tommy became ill and had to go under surgery last April. So I've been fronting the band since April, and that's really, you're talking about something that's strange.
Tell me what's strange about it.
Well, here you have an American jazz trumpeter, a young trumpeter who's, these guys are old enough to be my father, or almost grandfather. And here I am teaching kids all over the world about the history of Jamaica's music. You know, it's just the ironies of life. You never know where you're going to end up.
Now tell me what you love about playing ska and about having that beat, that kind of unchanging beat behind you.
Well, the beat is the bass player has such an instrumental role in the Skatalite music, Lloyd Brevet. We played a gig at the House of Blues when it first opened in Los Angeles, and Paul Schaefer and the whole band was there. And so he came backstage after the show, and Paul ran right up to Brevet, the bass player, and said, "I've never in my entire life seen a bass man drive a band like that." And meanwhile, Brevet was asking me, "Who is this guy? Who is?"
You're really bridging two different worlds.
Yeah, he didn't even know who David Letterman is, you know. So they still live in the world of Jamaica, even though they've been in the U.S. for quite a while.
Do you speak the same language? And I mean that literally. Do the rest of the Skatalites speak
patois.
With a strong accent? Yeah.
Oh, very strong. Very strong patois. It took me a couple of years to even understand what they were saying.
Have you picked up the language?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm part of the family. I've been to Jamaica a couple times with the band, and I've met the prime minister, Mr. P.J. Patterson, who used to manage the band. So he had us, after his inauguration, come to the government house for tea, and it was really nice. And when I shook his hand, he said, "Oh, man, I remember you from last year." That was a special moment in my life.
Now, I want to play some more music.
Okay.
The Skatalites, I think, recorded Guns of Navarone a whole bunch of times. And the most recent time is on a record from a couple of years ago, High Bop Ska.
Right.
And you're on this record.
Right.
Now, this is like the theme from the movie.
Right.
Guns of Navarone. And it's such an anthem-like tune. It's such a big tune. I think
the kids love it. They go crazy in Europe. They all know the melody and sing along with us. It's really frightening the first time I experienced it with an audience of like 1,000 kids singing da 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 da.
This is the Guns of Navarone featuring the Skatalites, and my guest Nathan Breedlove is featured on trumpet.
Bye.
That's the Guns of Navarone featuring the Scatolites from their record High Bop Ska. Nathan Breedlove, the trumpeter, is my guest. You travel, I imagine, around the world with the Scatolites now.
Oh, yes, yes. We go to Europe at least a couple times a year, in Japan. And we've been close to Africa, right off the coast of Africa, just everywhere.
What's the ska scene like in different cities around the world?
Oh, it's really wild in Europe. We've spent a lot of time in France over the last couple of years, so we really have a big following all over France. Germany, of course, is insane, you know. And we have a following. Even the Skinheads, you know, call us their first band, which is another story in itself.
Well, I want to hear that story. That must be pretty peculiar.
Oh, yeah. I played a concert in Potsdam, Germany, formerly East Germany, and it was like 2,000 Skinheads. And it was really quite an experience, you know.
Well, you see, I could imagine not being sure whether they came to applaud you or kill you.
Oh, they love the Scatolite music because that's a whole political situation that really hasn't been explored fully as far as, you know, the kids' aspirations that call themselves Skinheads, you know.
So what about in Jamaica? Is there much of a ska scene left in Jamaica?
No. Speaking of oddities, we're really an oddity in Jamaica. The first time we played there after a number of years was, I think, 1992. We went down for Independence Day. And Tommy McCook had built this big thing in my mind about how the response was going to be. And I really felt sad for him because he told me, we're going to play Freedom Sound, right? And when we play da-da-dee, da-da-da-dee, da-da-da-da-da, everybody's going to go, ray, ray, right? So I'm down, and we play the da-da-dee, and there's silence, you know. People are looking around like, where's the house music? We want the reggae, man. So they weren't accustomed to hearing the ska because all they hear is the house and the rap, you know, Jamaica style.
So you're considered old-fashioned in Jamaica?
Yes, and that was the first experience. Now, the second time we did a special concert for Mr. Patterson, who had just was the new prime minister. So we played in a park that was right in the heart of Kingston for the real people of Jamaica, you know, not the tourists or anything. And it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal, Terry. I can't tell you how it felt to have. They had generals with the braids on their shoulders and just the people of the streets, and they loved it. The kids had never seen instrumental music in person, you know, people playing horns or anything.
Nathan Breedlove, thank you so much. Really been fun to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Nathan Breedlove is the trumpeter with the Scatolites. Their latest album, High Bop Ska, is on Shanaki Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Having trouble readjusting to your busy schedule after vacation? Coming up, we talk with Dr. Stefan Rechtschaffen, author of Time Shifting, a book about how we relate to the pressure of never having enough time. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of duets and arias. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the Labor Day weekend is over, and so are our summer vacations, we have to readjust to the daily grind and to the beat-the-clock mentality. There's too much to do and not enough time to do it, so we speed up. But there's always a limit to how fast we can go. My guest, Dr. Stefan Rechtschaffen, says time pressure is not only exasperating, it's becoming a health crisis, causing many stress-related illnesses. Rechtschaffen is an MD and a founder of the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in New York. He's written a new book called Time Shifting, about how to best adapt to the flow of time.
I find that 95% of the people that I work with feel this sense of never having enough time in our lives, this sense of an absolute time pressure that seems to engulf us, and it's like the dogs that are hounding us all the time. And this is very particular to life in modern society. This is not the way most people have lived on this planet. Even nowadays, there are certain cultures, for instance, in New Guinea, where there's no word in the language for an hour, or there's no word for minute or seconds. And yet in our culture, we have this word we call a nanosecond, which divides time up into billionths of seconds. We've converted our way of life to one where we're so focused on efficiency, and time is the measure of efficiency, that we're trying to see how much we can do in the shortest possible time. And the result of this is that we feel that we never have enough time. There's always something we need to be doing, something that we could be doing, something to be more productive. And unfortunately, the toll has been the incredible amount of stress that people feel in their lives. I consider, as a physician, that most of the diseases I see are related to severe stress, and this stress is mostly related to the feeling of not having enough time, this pressure that we continually feel. And even worse than many of the diseases that we see is the fact that so many of us don't really enjoy our lives because we feel we need to be moving on quickly to the next thing we have in front of us.
Now, your new book is all about time and how we use it and how we relate to it, but there's a difference between what you're trying to do and what is commonly known as time management. What's the difference?
Well, time management has really been the societal response to looking at time as a measure of efficiency. So we look to manage our time better to try and do two or three or four things at once. The common term is multitasking. Now, I think time management can be very useful for people, but what I observe is that most people who know how to do time management, it's as though the treadmill of their life has now been turned on to fast forward. And we do more things, and we consider ourselves with great pride, because since early on in our childhood, we've been taught to achieve and to produce more. And so as we manage our time better, we seem to get more done. But the problem is, though we run at a faster speed to the applause of everyone around us, in actuality, we actually have less time. And I think one of the things that happens is we begin to emulate all those busy people. As Servan Schreiber, the French author, wrote in The Art of Time, he said for years he admired all the people who were so busy and were accomplishing so much until he realized they were just totally stressed out. And I think this is what's happening to us. We emulate those people who are most stressed in society, and then we too develop that stress, and then we wonder why we always feel at the effect of this pressure and this stress.
So if you're not into time management as a way of multitasking, what are you trying to change?
Well, I'm trying to look at it in a larger view, because what I find is that though we become more productive, we actually feel less at ease in time. We feel that time is too much our enemy. And what I'm trying to show people is how to befriend time so that we're not always at the effect of it. So time shifting is really beginning to look at time in terms of its rhythms. Most of us don't relate to time in a way that I think we need, and we need to shift this awareness of time. Most of us relate to time merely as the clock or the schedule. And if we begin to look at time more as the rhythmic dimension of life, what begins to happen is we see that time exists in many different rhythms. There's work time, there's leisure time, there's time with family, there's time with friends. And all of these times have very different rhythms. And it's shifting from one rhythm to another that we need to really learn how to do, and do with really much greater ease. I find that there's a real difference between what I call mental time and emotional time. You see, mental time is something where it happens very fast. For instance, if I say to you, Terry, think of a red balloon, think of a green elephant, think of a circular table. It's very easy to follow those images. But the moment I say, let's shift it to feelings. Now, if you feel sad, try and feel angry. Now feel rapturously in love. We have difficulty staying with those as feelings. What happens is we start to think about them. We try and imagine what the feeling is. But the processing of a feeling takes longer. And what happens for most of us all day long is that when a feeling rises up, we tend to push it down because we're so busy. So we get on doing all the things that we have to do. We don't have time for the feelings. And yet what happens for many people is as we're going fast all the time, I'll then say, what happens when the weekend comes and you're sitting on a couch with nothing to do? Then immediately people will say, well, I feel anxious. I feel a little terrified. I feel like I should be doing something. I feel guilty. And it's as though we have this eject button by the couch, and we push the eject button. We grab the telephone. We immediately go and do something. We do some chores. We do some shopping. We turn on the television or the radio. So we have difficulty allowing ourselves to slow down because, in a way, those feelings start to rise up again, and we don't really want to spend time with that. So we often just get busy again.
Well, let me say, sure, people are trying to, people have identity problems or they're insecure or they want to escape from the pain of life by keeping busy. On the other hand, and this is particularly true for parents, if you have a job and you're a parent and you're dealing with the responsibilities in both worlds, there's just too much to be done.
Yes, I certainly...
Let me put it in personal terms for you, okay? You're a doctor. You want to keep your schedule, so that there's me time in it. There's time just for yourself, time to breathe, time to respect the moment. Say patients call you after hours and, you're into being in the moment and everything, and one of them's having a heart attack or a kidney failure or something.
Sure.
What are you going to do?
Well, I think in that moment, that's where you have to shift to. I think if you've taken on those responsibilities, but I see too often what happens is, let me give you an example of the way I think this work, and we'll go into it a little more. A friend of mine, a physician, did a wonderful thing. He was always afraid to go on roller coasters. So what he did is he went to the bottom of a roller coaster with a telephoto lens, and he took pictures of people coming over the top. And basically he found there were just two responses. The first response is people hanging on for dear life with their hands on the bar, knuckles white, neck veins popping, a shriek in their face, and it's as though all of stress in this one moment of time. The second group of pictures is people with their arms raised, big smile on their face, just going for it, just absolutely the thrill of it, just letting go to the moment. And the wonderful thing was the last picture, which was my friend Sid, and that's him coming over the top, having learned to just let go and really having a wonderful time. Now, in the midst of our busy life, we have these opportunities all the time. And it's almost cliche. You say, is the glass half empty or half full? But if this is the life we have and we recognize we need to be so busy, how do we start to turn it around and find the places where we start to open it just a little bit? It's like our commute home. As on National Public Radio, there was a study reported where people were commuting about a 45-minute difference. One group was told to go as fast as they possibly could, cutting in and out of lanes, and the next group to just take their time. The second group arrived only 2 or 3 minutes later, but clearly a lot more relaxed. And so I look to this and say, because I used to be someone, when I would commute, I would go as fast as I possibly could because I considered it a waste of time. I wanted to fax myself to work if only I could. And so now as I've opened that time up a little bit, I realize this is a time I have by myself. This is a time that I can just be in the car. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to get a cellular phone. I don't have to try and make it productive. And in my busy day, I have a little rest as I go from one place to another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stefan Rechtschaffen, and he's the founder of the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in New York and author of the new book, Time Shifting. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stefan Rechtschaffen. He's the author of the new book, Time Shifting, Creating More Time to Enjoy Your Life. You point out that in families, a lot of the arguments between partners occurs when one person's coming home from work and re-entering the home, and the sense of time at home is really different than it was at work. So talk about that a little bit, about what you recommend to prevent that disorientation and stress and conflict.
Yes, well, Terry, I think critical here is that as I talk about time as rhythm, there is the phenomenon of entrainment, and entrainment is rhythms coming into synchrony. And one of the things that we can note is that when there's a good communication taking place, we're usually in rhythm with another person. Now, what happens often is that one person has been at the rhythm of work, one is at the rhythm of the household, and when you arrive, you're in different rhythms. And I think that's the greatest chance when a couple will have a fight or an argument, because they're in different rhythms.
So what do you recommend to people before they enter the house in order to get in sync with the rhythm of the house?
Well, I know
they're returning home from work.
Yeah, I know that sometimes what I've done is if I feel particularly stressed, I'll drive past the house. And I have a little spot, I'll go park and I'll sit there for a few minutes just to allow my rhythm to shift. I think when we first come home, it's important to have a little ritual that one does. And when I say that, many of us already do. I'm interested in honoring that ritual, whether it's changing our clothes or taking the dog for a walk or petting the cat or taking a shower, something that allows us to recognize that it's time for the rhythm to shift. Now, I think as we start to do that, it allows us to be in this new rhythm, this different rhythm that works better with our family, with our children, and so on.
So time shifting to you is about changing your rhythms to the rhythm of the task that you're doing or the person that you're with?
Absolutely. Each moment has a particularly different rhythm, and it's a question of finding that. It's not... What I'm talking about is not called downshifting. I don't think people need to just slow down all the time. I like to be really at a fast pace, but I recognize that if I'm only at a fast pace, it's like running the marathon of life as though it's at the pace of a 100-yard dash. That's why people are dying of heart attacks and other stress disorders. I think if we learn to shift our rhythms, for instance, one of the things that we see is the great sports stars. And I think this is one of the ways to be more effective in one's life. Ted Williams, for instance, when he would be in the zone of hitting a baseball, where he was really totally focused on it, he would say that when he was hitting the ball well, a ball thrown at him 90 or 100 miles an hour would look like it was coming in slow motion, the size of a grapefruit. He could see the seams on the ball as they would spin, because he would allow himself to come so totally focused in this moment. He didn't have the anxiety, am I going to hit the ball? He wasn't worried about the future. Now, we've all had experiences like that. For instance, if someone's had a car accident, as you have the car accident, you come right in, you can vividly remember the details that take place, because you're not there thinking, well, I wonder what I'm going to have for lunch, or where am I going on vacation next week? We become totally present. When we allow ourselves to be present like that, what happens is we start to live so fully in this moment that we actually become far more effective. And so it's just a question of allowing ourselves to be here in what the rhythm of this moment is. And then life opens up for us and we actually begin to create time and not feel the continual pressure of it.
I put that in the easier said than done category. What are some of the things that you do to help yourself be present in the moment?
Well, I think that rituals actually help us a lot. And one of the key rituals is the use of the breath. Because what happens is when you're stressed out in life, the breath starts to go up high in the lungs. It's very short, it's shallow. And yet the breath is this rhythm that's taking place all the time. No matter whether we're conscious of our breathing or not, it's happening in a rhythmic fashion. Now, it's the one rhythmic function of the body that we can immediately choose to change. And as you take a deep breath and just let the breath come down into the abdomen to slow it down, to take it in a relaxed way, you can feel your whole body shift. You can feel a sense of relaxation. I actually think that this is what the cigarette break's been about for so long. And I always recommend to to people I'm working with to take the non-cigarette cigarette break. Because you see people go into a hallway when smoking was more allowed, and they sit back in a chair and relax and take this hot air into the lungs. And one of the things it does is it just allows you to relax into your breathing, and the whole body relaxes with it. So I often suggest people to close their eyes, take a few minutes of just a few deep breaths, or even when the telephone rings. The telephone rings, and instead of being like a Pavlovian dog where we just jump for the bell, instead to take a breath, to allow ourselves to be here. And it's really these pauses. One of the ways, you see, when I start to talk about this, people say, well, I'm too busy to do this. But in truth, we have opportunities for these pauses all the time. And it's the little pauses in life that start to allow us the freedom of time. And this is, as the great pianist Arthur Rubinstein, who was once asked how it was that he played the notes so well. He said, the notes I play like every other pianist, but the pauses, the pauses. And this is where we start to open our lives and start to feel more sense of fulfillment.
Now, here's a tricky thing about becoming present in the moment. It's hard to be present in the moment when you're always faced with decisions about the future. And you have, you know, job decisions and personal decisions and home decisions. And whenever you have a minute, you're thinking, well, I should really be puzzling through what I want to do or what the solution is or what the next step should be. And everybody's faced with these decisions, complicated ones.
Well, absolutely. And I actually think, and this may sound slightly contradictory to what I'm saying, I think people don't plan enough. And I think that's one of the problems. You see, what happens is we start to look into the future, and then we develop some anxiety about the future. We're uncertain about it. So no sooner have we started to look into the future than when the anxiety arises and we start to feel upset about it, uncomfortable, not sure about it, then we flash back to the past. Then we're in the present. And I think if we plan well, then we know the direction that we're going. The plans aren't written in stone. It's not carved in stone. We can change those plans however we want. But most of the sort of that future indecision that we have, those concerns about what to do, I find is more related to anxiety. And the way to deal with that anxiety is to really just come into the present moment. The more we allow ourselves to be right here and to be in this moment, the future starts to unfold itself in a way that works much better for us. Because I find when I feel in the flow, and I describe this sort of flow feeling as when there's no future, there's no past, you're just here and everything's fine. What starts to happen is the future unfolds for me in a way that works in a much better way than when I'm worrying about it.
Dr. Stefan Rechtschaffen is a founder of the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in New York. His new book is called Time Shifting. Well, here's a song that says it all, written and sung by Dave Frischberg.
I'll be late getting home from the office, and so will you. 'Cause we both got a million calls to return and a million things to do. We're not seeing enough of each other. 'Cause truth be told, we're up to our ears in our careers, and we're putting our hearts on hold. So, darling, let me bring you up to speed. A little time together's what we need. Quality time. We both deserve a little quality time. I know a small hotel, remote and quiet. If they decide to sell, my firm could buy it. Then we develop it and gentrify it. We're talking quality time. Quality time. We both have earned a little quality time. In the Bahamas we can watch our stress go. We'll walk along the beach and dine al fresco. I'll take a power lunch with Robert Vesco. We're talking quality time. Come fly with me, unwind, kick back, relax. I'll bring my laptop fax. You'll work on your new screenplay. I'll update my resume. Quality time, a little frolic and frivolity time. We'll take a seminar in self-hypnosis. so we can learn to stop and smell the roses. We'll do a workshop on the grieving process. Learning to cry is no crime. We're talking quality time.
That's Dave Frischberg. Coming up, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new album of duets and arias. This is Fresh Air. They're young, they're beautiful, and they're in love. They're also opera singers. They're Romanian soprano Angela Gheorghiu and Sicilian-French tenor Roberto Alagna. They got married last spring between performances at the Met. Their first recording as a couple is an album of arias and duets. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the duets, more than the arias, are what makes this album so special.
It's been a long time since a soprano and a tenor were publicly in love with each other just as their careers were taking off. Angela Gheorghiu and Roberto Alagna met in 1992 in their Covent Garden debuts as the young lovers in La Bohème. They practically spent their honeymoon on stage. The day after they were married, they appeared together at the Met, both in Bohème and on the televised six-hour James Levine 25th anniversary gala, singing the enchanting Cherry duet from Mascagni's L'Amico Fritz. They were adorable, loving, and tenderly attentive. This duet is also one of the highlights of their new disc, though they're not as charming as another married couple, Pia Tassinari and Ferruccio Tagliavini, whom the composer himself chose for his famous recording half a century ago. And conductor Richard Armstrong isn't as sensitive as either Mascagni or Levine. It's nevertheless an endearing souvenir of a happy moment for these appealing young singers. Gheorghiu and Alagna's stories are already the stuff of myth. Alagna is 32, a Sicilian from Paris. 2 years ago, his first wife died of a brain tumor, leaving him with a small daughter. He was probably not discovered, as is frequently reported, in a pizzeria. but he evidently really was inspired by Mario Lanza movies on TV and really did teach himself to sing by listening to records. His voice is clear and focused, with strong Italianate high notes and impressively crisp and natural diction, especially in French. But he can also sound dry, and though he's said to be a good stage actor, on disc he tends to let everything sound the same. Gheorghiu is 30 and went to the conservatory in Bucharest. Her voice is warm, fluid, and flexible, though her intonation can get a little edgy. She looks like a ballerina with long, dark hair and fragile doe eyes, perfect for Verdi and Puccini's consumptive heroines. Her recording and video of La Traviata have been getting consistently better reviews than Alanya's solo album. Her new solo album is also a little disappointing. Still, it's as a team that Alanya and Gheorghiu have captured our imaginations. In the Tonight duet from West Side Story, their English is a little shaky, but they're better matched than Kyrie Kanawa and Jose Carreras on Bernstein's own recording. They're touching and ardent in the garden scene from Faust, and despite a sluggish tempo, ecstatic in the love duet between Dido and Aeneas, also in French, from Berlioz's The Trojans. It'll be fun to see what happens to Gheorghiu and Alanya. So far, they seem to be handling the hype with good grace. Everyone wants them to succeed. And if they do, it'll be better than fun.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Soul's Code, In Search of Character and Calling by James Hillman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.